We'll be taking a look at primarily three questions are just going to guide our approach, and we'll deal with some sub-questions to these, but these are the three primary questions. Why should we teach it? And that is apologetics in Christian education. When do we teach it? And I already mentioned that we're going to be looking at a program that's going to recognize from preschool all the way through to high school. And then the question of how should it be taught? And of course, related to when and how is also where it should be done. And we'll be taking a brief look at that as well. So that's kind of the approach that I'm going to take to the topic. Before we jump in, though, to make sure that we're all on the same page as to what Christian apologetics is, because there's a lot of misconceptions. And I'll tell you, if I often thought the other day that if someone just looks on the internet to learn about Christian apologetics, they're going to be confused as to what it is, depending on what they click on and what they look at. So I need to see that we're all on the same page with regards to clarifying what Christian apologetics is that we're implementing, at least as I see it, and implementing it into Christian education. And the second thing I want to preliminarily do in terms of clarifying is some statistical misconceptions out there, at least my take on them, and you can at least judge for yourself. Whether I've got it right or wrong, but I have a bit different take on some of the statistics that are thrown out there quite a bit, and I want to kind of set the stage for clearing up any misconceptions regarding them. So here's a definition. This is a definition that I would consider equivalent to a 9th through 12th grade definition. If I was teaching 9th through 12th grade, this is what I would tell the first day of class or first week or whatever, what they're studying. This is how I would give it to them. It's the application of knowledge to demonstrate that Christianity is true. Students understand knowledge. They study different subjects that they're familiar with. But that Christianity can be shown to be true is probably something they're not all that familiar with. And that's what apologetics is about. And any approach to apologetics, and this is my take on it, but any approach to apologetics that doesn't arrive at the conclusion Christianity is true and everything that is opposed to it is false is an incorrect approach to Christian apologetics. I don't care what the approach is called, I don't care what names we give it. If the conclusion is not Christianity is true, then it's a wrong approach as far as I'm concerned to Christian apologetics. And granted, there are a number of different approaches to apologetics. I'm going to give you a few, some real brief summaries. And these definitions I give you, in fact, almost all the definitions I give you are at a high school level of what I would expect them to be able to know. And yeah, at a high school level, we do cover different approaches to doing apologetics because they're going to run into that. I certainly want to teach them the right approach, but I also want to be able to show them an incorrect approach. Not all apologetics are created equally. The first one is the correct approach, and its name traditionally is classical. And this is where rational arguments for God's existence are used, and evidence, particularly we could add in there, for the historical truth of Christianity is done. It's the traditional two-step method. It goes back to the Apostle Paul and his approach. In fact, just today in Sunday school, we were studying Acts chapter 8, and the approach is right there in Paul's methodology, which he continues in Acts 17. He even lays it out in the book of Romans. It is to clarify and sometimes even argue for the existence of God to make sure that the person you're dealing with has the correct concept of God, and in that context, to deliver evidence, particularly historical evidence, for the resurrection, which shows that Christianity is true. But there's other approaches. There's an evidential approach, which exclusively uses some evidence for the truth of Christianity. This is a complete historical approach in most cases that ignores arguments for the existence of God. It's kind of the second half of a classical approach, or it's a classical approach, I'm sorry, it's an evidential approach that leaves out the arguments for the existence of God. And then there's some who approach it completely from an experiential vantage point. They say all we should give is our Christian testimony, and that is our apologetic. I was primarily raised in a church that probably could be characterized as that approach. The only thing we have is our testimony and our experience of being transformed by Christ, and that's our apologetic. Next approach is a presuppositional approach. There are lots of different kinds of presuppositional approach, but primarily all of them have in common a denial of universal common ground with unbelievers. And therefore, they favor the assumption of some Christian truth. And depending on what proponent you would look at, you would have different assumptions of certain truths that would be considered Christian truths that just need to be assumed. And therefore, we reason about the Christian truth, and we can certainly compare and contrast them. But again, there's no common ground like the classical approach would reinforce. And then, of course, there's the probably the newest of all of these is this combinational approach that basically says there's no approach, including the classical method of apologetics, there's no approach that is complete or sufficient, we might say. So what we need to then do is just pick and choose from different approaches and put together what seems best in most cases for the recipient of apologetics. And I'm all for customizing our apologetics in the sense of making it understandable, making it gentleness and reverence, and to make it so that it's understandable in a contextualized sense or a cross-contextualized sense. I'm all for it being kind, no problem with that. But to think that there's something wrong with the classical approach, I think, is incorrect. And fundamentally, all of the approaches, evidential, experiential, presuppositional, and combinational, declare that the classical approach is wrong, is what the bottom line comes down to. They might take things from it, but they believe that the overall approach is wrong. And I obviously oppose that. Let me at least give you two reasons for that to be the case. The first one is that arguments for God's existence are universally valid and true, and hence they're demonstrative. That may seem odd in our cultural context that I could assert such a thing, but if you go back to the medieval periods, the time of Thomas Aquinas and Augustine, that's how they viewed those arguments. They were demonstrative because they worked from a very different philosophical vantage point than philosophers work today. Today, philosophers are analytical and skeptical about knowledge and understanding and what philosophy can do. In the medieval time period, they were much more certain about those things because they had a different philosophical approach, what I consider a correct approach, which is realism, or sometimes referred to as moderate realism. It's there that because all of humanity understands and knows things the same way, that we can say our arguments aren't just a cumulative case or probabilistic or in some cases helpful. I make the assertion that they're demonstrative, and that's why apologetics can arrive at the conclusion that it can arrive at. The other reason is that there is a valid systematic argument from ground zero to the absolute truth of Christianity. If you've ever seen Dr. Geiser's 12 points that show Christianity is true, that's what he's famous for. As a ground zero argument, starting with an undeniable first principle and arriving at the conclusion that Christianity is true and everything opposed to it is indeed false. Well, only the classical method is going to get you to that end, if that is indeed our end, as the definition I gave you states. So that's my approach, and I'm sticking to it. That's the way I was educated. I admire a lot of apologists in some of the other areas, but I think that they are wrong and incorrect, and I think it can even be shown that that is the case. So that's the first precondition that I wanted to clear up, or first clarification I wanted to make. The second one has to do with this, and boy, I'll tell you, I'm going to step on a lot of toes with this one. I might run into it here, and I definitely run into it other places that I go. But follow me on this, and you're certainly welcome to disagree with me, but at least we'll give you a chance to hear an opposing viewpoint with some who definitely have put forward this. Let me give you what I think is a poor reason to do apologetics. I'm going to give you some good reasons to do apologetics, but I think this is a poor reason to do apologetics. You will often hear it said, 70% of Christian youth leave the church in college. That's true. That is true, and I'll show you why it's true. I have better evidence here that I'll show you than probably you will get anywhere else. That's true. However, I don't think that's a good reason to do apologetics. In fact, have you ever wondered, what about the kids that don't go to college? Do they end up leaving the church? You know what? It's higher than 70%. If you don't go to college, it's up to 76% actually end up stopping their church attendance. And that's what's really behind this, is stopping church attendance. Here's a study from the Social Science Research Council that was done in 2007. And they say data from 30 years of the General Social Science Survey pinpoints the age 22. Now, 30 years of study, that's a longitudinal study. That's just not a headline in a paper of somebody doing a study. For the past 30 years, they've been tracking this. That's why I say it's got, from a statistical standpoint, it's a strong statistic that age 22 as the point in the life course when average levels of weekly or more frequently church attendance are at their lowest, 17%. The climb back into regular or semi-regular religious practice, if it occurs at all, and it usually does, is often simulated by marriage and childbearing. Once you get out of your nest, your family, whether you go to college or you don't go to college, 70%, roughly speaking, are going to stop their church attendance. Does that mean they have given up on Christianity? Some of them may be so. There are some alarming statistics out there. And I don't necessarily think, and I could be wrong, that if we're able to integrate Christian apologetics into all of education, as I'm going to lay out for you here, that we're going to stop that statistic or fix that statistic. In fact, I would venture to say that if Christian apologetics is taught, as I'm going to lay it out here, from preschool all the way through high school, and it's done pretty much universally, you're still going to have a high statistic of people stopping their church attendance after they leave the home when they're out on their own, whether they're in college or not. That's not to say that college is not corrosive for their Christian education. It is. There are other alarming statistics out there. But even myself included, when I left home and I went to college for the first time, if you came in on any Sunday morning to my dorm room, I was probably sleeping in. I was not in church. And if I recorded my church attendance, it wouldn't have been very good at all during my first years in college. Even some of my other years in college, it would definitely have been sporadic. And that's just the way it is. And it's not until they get out of college or later on in life when they get married and all of a sudden they have a kid and all of a sudden they realize, I need help raising this child, and they return to the church for that reason. Those students who quote unquote lose their faith, and there's statistics that that's the case, in college or drop out of organized religion after high school are primarily those already at considerable risk of doing so for other reasons that predate these actions. To suggest the die is cast before the dorm room is occupied may be too strong a claim, but not by much. As Christian Smith and Melinda Denton, 2005 note, and Soul Searching, which is a very good book, tend to get what they are when it comes to their teenagers' religious sense. And they go on to say, if parents do not actively affirm and transmit the oral and written traditions of a religion, their failure to teach the language results in youth who cannot speak the language and are at elevated risk of shedding the religious value system altogether. Indeed, scholars often forget that religion is primarily taught, not caught or transmitted by osmosis. So what we're really looking at here overall is a failure that's in the home. It's a failure that's with respect to parents, and they're educating their children in terms of not only their religion, but as we'll see, also with respect to Christian apologetics. And if you take any class on Christian education, one of the first things that is drilled into you is everything out there like the church, parachurch ministries, Christian schools, everything is ancillary to what goes on in the home. And if it doesn't happen in the home, even what's going on outside is just ancillary to it, and it's probably not going to be as effective as it should be. It needs to be in the home. So one of the things I want to emphasize, my big idea, is that at this point, the most important person to receive training in Christian apologetics are the parents. And after that, the teachers. And after that, the pastors. Because they are going to transmit it to the children. And if they're not trained in it, then the kids aren't going to get trained in it. So let's go ahead and start. Why should we teach it? We'll start with that and then proceed to when do we teach it and how do we teach it. First of all, why should we teach apologetics? Let me give you three reasons, and we'll talk briefly about these. We should teach Christian apologetics in Christian education because the Bible commands the use of apologetics. History demonstrates its success. and a contemporary need exists for it as well. Just briefly, you may be familiar with these, but for whether I am in chains, Paul says in Philippians, when he's in prison, or defending and confirming the gospel, all of you share in God's grace with me, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. Paul saw it as essential to his life and his ministry, defending and confirming the gospel, whether he was in chains or whether he was free. It did not matter. It was his whole ministry. But in your hearts, set Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. Peter here writes to the common Christian, not the educated Christian. Most of them were probably uneducated. In the face of rising persecution, that the one thing among many other things that they should be concerned about is to be able to, well, one, be prepared, and two, to give an answer when they're asked. Apologetics in the face of persecution should be done. So when we're not being persecuted, how much more should we be engaged in Christian apologetics? And finally, Jude tells us, dear friends, although I was very eager to write to you about the salvation we share, I felt I had to write and urge you to contend for the faith that was once for all entrusted to the saints. So the Bible commands us to do apologetics, and certainly an implication of that is doing it in the home and in Christian education. And history demonstrates it. Paul used it, as I mentioned it before, he used it against Judaism, Hellenism, and even early Gnosticism as recorded in the New Testament. In fact, Paul had the same method wherever he went. If he went to the Jews, he was able to reason to the Old from the Old Testament because there was already a theistic context that existed for them. He didn't have to argue or clarify the existence of God because the Jews already accepted monotheism. What he did there was to appeal to the scriptures themselves with respect to an apologetic. But when he went into Hellenism, he faced Socratic philosophers, those who were polytheists in the world. He faced those who were atheists from the Greek background as well. And he always began by clarifying who God was as opposed to who God was not in those contexts. That was his approach. And he met with some who believed, some who wanted to hear him again, and some who resisted him and did not believe. We should expect today to happen as well. In the third century, probably the most significant person is Origen in terms of writing on Christian apologetics. His doctrine is not good, but he wrote a treatise on apologetics. Probably the most extensive treatise on apologetics was written by Origen in the third century. And the arguments he used for the resurrection are still used today by modern Christian apologists. Augustine wrote against paganism when he wrote The City of God. He was writing primarily and doing an apologetic against paganism. And it was probably the greatest apologetic work written up to that point. Aquinas in the Middle Ages is without a doubt the most important Christian apologist. He was asked by Catholic missionaries to give them a small treatise or a treatise on apologetics to deal with the spread of Islam in Spain. Well, Aquinas never wrote anything that was short. In our modern versions, it's 5 volumes. It's called the Summa Contra Gentiles, and it is probably up to that point the most sophisticated from ground zero all the way to the truth of Christianity apologetic that was written up to that point. And it did find use with Spanish missionaries because some of those Spanish missionaries were able to copy arguments from Aquinas, and we know it because they also wrote smaller treatises and tracts for people to read, and it all came from Aquinas' work. So they found some use for it in a missionary context. And a contemporary need exists. This I don't need to do much because you live in our contemporary society, but obviously objections to Christianity need to be taken seriously, and they come from all venues. Many Christian teenagers get exposed from TV, media, movies, in school, out of school, friends. It comes from everywhere. And they, of course, are going to develop questions. And if there's no place that they can go to have those questions openly asked, addressed, and answered at a level that they can understand, then they're going to remain the gaps in their understanding and in their education that are not filled, that could be filled by Christian apologetics. When they go off to the university and college, teachers and professors will be in positions of authority over them that will give them views that are clearly contrary to Christianity, even to the point of belittling and mocking Christianity. And of course, our media today promotes scholarly views that are contrary to Christianity. So again, our contemporary need has never been greater for needing apologetics in Christian education. So when do we teach it? It's here that I'm going to give you a warning that Christ gave that's extremely important. And probably, if you deal with those who are under the secondary school level, which is 9th through 12th grade, this is the most important thing that I would say to you from Christ himself. Jesus said in Matthew 18, 5 through 6, "And whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea." In other words, Jesus is saying that if you cause a young child to stumble in their faith, cause them to stumble, then you will face judgment in this life. Doesn't matter if you're a believer or an unbeliever, you'll face temporal judgment here and now. So this is very serious for the Christian, as well as the unbeliever. The way faith works for us and the way faith works even for a child is the same. Faith is believing something is true based on someone's authority. My daughter believes that God exists because I tell her that God exists. For her, it is by faith that she accepts it. She believes that God exists because her teachers at school, at church, tell her that, because she reads the Bible and the Bible tells her that. Now what apologetics is doing in terms of its nature is it's introducing a reason why God exists that's apart from faith. It's not contrary to faith, but it's a demonstration apart from faith. And this is very important. You don't want to take that reason in apologetics and introduce it into the child's curriculum at any point before they're able to reason themselves about this issue and accept that truth apart from authority. So it would be wrong, for example, to take arguments for the existence of God and introduce it into the elementary school level. That's not what Christian apologetics is about at that level. I'll discuss what it is about, but that's not what it's about. Because that's introducing something that is meant to substitute for faith, and it could cause the child to stumble if I give them reasons that, admittedly, if abstract thinking is not developed and it's not fully developed in the elementary school age, then we could cause that child to stumble, not knowing which one they're supposed to be engaged with, the authority, the Bible, the pastor, I accept it because they say it, or this argument I don't completely understand, or this reason I don't completely understand. So that's extremely important to keep in mind when we integrate Christian apologetics at a level that is below the secondary school level. So this is what I propose with regards to a method of instruction. When you're dealing with preschool age, you want things to be informal and direct. In fact, what I'm going to give you in the curriculum here in just a little bit is at the preschool level, elementary school level, and even to a certain extent when we start to make a transition into abstract reasoning with regards to the middle and junior high level, where we can do some formal and direct instruction. One of the things that I want to bring your attention to are benchmarks that I'm going to give you, where I say, okay, as a teacher, parent, doesn't matter, my child or the child I oversee has reached this benchmark. And it hasn't been disrupted and it hasn't been removed. And so those really become benchmarks that they're naturally going to progress into. And all of this is done in the context of what I would call a normal Christian education development, where there is instruction regarding Christianity. If that's not the case, some of the things I say may not apply. It's when you get into high school, full force with regards to Christian apologetics that is at their level can take place, because about the age of 14 or 15 years old, that's when they have fully developed abstract reasoning skills. So it's possible to then start giving them arguments, which are important to give because they are facing, obviously, a counter position in our culture and society. Where do we teach it? Well, let me give you at least three areas, which you already know about, but this is where it needs to be done. In the home, parent to child, where it can be done informally and formally as well. Now, I didn't describe the difference between, maybe I should, regarding informal versus formal. Formal is where you create a lesson and you actually teach to fulfill an objective. And as long as you have the benchmarks in mind, you can teach to those benchmarks that I'm going to give you. Informally is, for example, when your child just asks you a question when you're out doing something, living life, and they just ask about something, and it becomes an opportune time. You watch a TV show, and they ask about something. That's what I mean by informally. It just happens. They're in the kitchen, and they're talking to you, and issues come up. In the church, between teacher, pastor, and parent, with the child formally. And obviously, in the Christian school, and I include homeschool in that as well, with regards to the teacher, to the child, all needs to be looked at. So those are the locations where it should be done. Now we're going to move to how do we indeed teach it. And of course, here I'm concerned about what mode or plan, and that's what I mean by a comprehensive curriculum. Now, I'm not going to give you, I can't show you a huge comprehensive curriculum, but I'm going to show you at least some samples of things that I have in mind. So we're first going to take a look at the model for a preschool curriculum. And it kind of looks like this, the stepping stones, and this model will be carried all the way through high school, actually, of starting with the world, because that is what children know first. They know the world first, and then they know about God, because again, in an authoritative faith structure, they are told with respect to God and His existence and what He is like, and they learn things about God from the Bible. And of course, on top of that is Jesus and how important He is. What a curriculum might look like with the benchmarks is this. When we begin with the world, you can see I've got classified things in the world they know. Speaks about the world of things they know. This is something the child is going to develop naturally. The issue are we sure that nothing is disrupting them? There's no skepticism there. There's no doubt with regards to the world and the things they know. And unless something introduces that, they're not going to have that. They effortlessly pick up that there's things in the world. I give an activity here. Walk through a forest saying the names of natural things that are found. I used to do this with my daughter when she was 2 years old, 3 years old, just beginning to speak. I would show her a spider. And after I showed her the name of the spider and what a spider was, she had no fear of spiders. That must be learned at some point because now she fears them at 11 years old. But nonetheless, then she was. In fact, when she saw another one, she just wanted to pick it up and put it in her mouth like everything else. No, we don't put spiders in our mouth. But she's going to naturally, she knows the world. At some point, if someone introduces, we don't know the world, that's being introduced by some foreign element out there that's making it skeptical with regards to knowing the world. Believes that God created the world, believes that certain Bible stories are truly occurred. There is a narrative there of true occurrences. There are parables that Jesus tell that don't involve real people, but nonetheless teach a truth that needs to be there. Do a craft. Kids are always doing crafts, so this is nothing new, that emphasizes how only God can create things in the world and we can only make things from the world. They understand that humans make a house, but they don't make a tree. Where did the tree come from? God created the tree. God causes the tree to be. Humans don't do that, but humans can make. So when they're making something, it's a perfect opportunity to introduce that. Believes that Jesus truly exists, believes that Jesus is the only, was the one and only Son of God. Natural things in Christian education they're going to have, all of these are ultimately related to a future course in apologetics they're going to take. That's why they're benchmarks. What is an integrative activity? This is something that can be done, and I did this with my daughter. Start an oral list of significant events that you have experienced with your child that you can tell and recall. When my child, 1 year old, I would recite to her orally about every single time we saw a fire engine with its lights and siren on going down the street. And we had a list, probably by the time she was later 4 or 5, we had a list of about 6 or 7 events that I gave to her. I recited them orally to her, even at night before she would go to bed. I would say, do you remember when we saw, and I would describe the first event in great detail. I would describe it to her. Eventually, I wrote that down for her. And eventually I had her write it down as well. This is going to become very important to later on in apologetics. A lot of it is based upon testimony of other people, and seeing the reliability of that testimony as she goes along in life will give her the confidence in things like scripture when she reads oral testimony later on that is given about events and things that happen. Everyone probably has experienced sitting in a circle and you tell one person one thing and it passes all around. It's completely different. That's not how oral testimony works. The teaching that Jesus did was very memorable. He had disciples that memorized, in that ancient context, they memorized his teaching. They put it to memory, not just to writing eventually, but to memory. So they not only had their own memory at work, and they had the assurance of the Holy Spirit there as well that bring those things to remembrance that they needed. But that's how things work. We are in a mindset where we just write everything down because we have to remember it. We have to put it in our phone. Otherwise, we forget it. We're not geared towards that muscle, remembering things and remembering teaching. But that's the way it was, and that is the way humans operate. So this is something that you can begin very early later on, and you'll see how this integrative activity goes further on. You can see these here with regards to reasons to truth or falsehood about things in the world and relationships. They should know some things are true if it's just when I tell the truth versus when I tell a lie, or someone else tells the truth or tells the lie, or either the dog is in the backyard or the dog's not in the backyard. This is just very simple laws of logic behind it, but of course, and this develops naturally. It's not something we need to teach, it's something they acquire, but I need to watch for it as a benchmark because it's important later to Christian apologetics. Recognizes that what is said is not said corresponds to the world, of course does not correspond to the world. Uses authority as a source of knowledge about God. Recognizes that the world and the Bible shows us truth. Again, things in common with Christian education, but I know that those things in Christian education later become important. It's here where you might, for example, evaluate a media. What I did is my daughter was bugging me. She was probably in fourth or fifth grade about watching Star Wars. Well, Star Wars has a completely pantheistic Eastern mindset associated with. So I took it as an opportunity to compare and contrast the Christian God with the Eastern God or the pantheistic God in order to show the contrast between them in terms of differences. So we contrasted in a rubric I had made up for her with quotes from the movie because I had seen it before, so that when the quote came up, she could identify and compare it with a Bible verse that countered it as well. It took a little bit of effort, but she kind of enjoyed it at the end. And got a chance to really compare and contrast and use media that was entertaining to her to show what was true and false with respect to the media and its view of God. Recognizes that others do not believe the same things. This is going to happen. She came home one day and she just blurted out to me in the kitchen one day, "What do Muslims believe about Jesus?" Well, now I have 2 degrees in Christian apologetics, so I could answer that. But the typical parent may not have training to be able to answer something like that. And if they aren't able to say what the difference is, that they have a different God, and they do have a different God that is not knowable. They have a different prophet that's not the true prophet. And they have a different book that's not the true book. To pick 3 things and compare and contrast that with what is true. Our view of God is that God is knowable, not unknowable. Our view of the prophet is that Jesus alone is the Son of God and the only way to God, and that Muhammad is a false prophet, and that the Quran is not the word of God, only the scriptures that we read are the word of God. For her to hear that is extremely important. For a parent to just say, "Oh, they just don't believe the right stuff, don't pay attention to it," and go on from there is not sufficient. That's not going to cut it. And I understand the parent may not be prepared, but that's why it needs to be important for the parent to be prepared. So write down this as we continue our integrative activity from the elementary school years. It's here that, from the preschool years, it's here when she's able to write down from memory the same list of significant events. We wrote down together and I even had her eventually handwrite it, copy what I had kind of written out, type, to go ahead and write it out by hand is very important. Significant events, for example, the fire engine experience with your child that you use to both tell and recall orally. And when the copy gets old, that's fine. Write another one. You can see what this is paralleling with regards to the New Testament and how it was copied and it was preserved, how things can be recorded accurately down that she recalls and remembers in her life. When we move into the middle school, it's here that reasoning starts to develop. So we reason to God for Christ is the model, where it was the world, and certainly we are still concerned about the world and those benchmarks before, but the model changes to reason to God for Christ. Here we have, here we can state things in terms of things, I've stated them as benchmarks, but here we could also have actual what we would call objectives that could be measurable, could start to be introduced, because here we can get into some formal teaching in Christian apologetics. Observes that some things said entail their own truth. Here I have in mind very first principles of thought. Being exists, or we put it in the terms of something exists. She should be able to recognize that some things I say are just true in themselves. They are the foundation to thought, and that's where thought ends. And this can be done in informal environments as well as a formal study of them as well, since they're easy for her to understand. Examines effects and reasons to their ultimate cause. Humans cause the house in terms of building it, but the things that the house is made out of, such as wood coming from a tree, what causes, she should reason that God causes the tree to exist. And here I'm talking about, no, I didn't say at the very beginning, like God made the first tree and then all the trees kind of caused themselves. Uh-uh. God causes the tree to exist right now. I won't get into the philosophy of that, but it's a distinction between actuality and potentiality and existence and metaphysics. She needs to know, she doesn't need to know the technical stuff behind it, but she needs to know that God causes things, like it says in Colossians 1:13, he causes things to exist right now. She should get this at the middle school level. Recognizes truth and falsehood about God, explains miracles, prophecy, a unique sign. Here, a great formal is to just match Old Testament prophecies with their New Testament. Just do two lists and have them match it, just like you could do a formal lesson in that. Judges accounts of the past and history to be reliable and unreliable. Hey, Abraham Lincoln was shot on such and such date and not any other date is something she should recognize with regards to history. And that some things in our society, some people in our society say certain things didn't happen in history, and they did happen, is a good thing for her to come to recognize. And certainly looking at falsehood about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. In fact, even when you read the Bible, you're going to come across that, because the first thing that was spread around is that the disciples stole the body. It's in Matthew's gospel. Here we continue our integrative activity. Play argue the significant events you experienced with your child and say that they never happened. We never saw the fire engines. And see what they do. What are they going to do? The wheels are just going to turn. I have to prove to my dad that we did not see the fire engines after all we've done in reciting it and writing it down. You can tell them that you're playing it. You can say, let's say a stranger came in and we told them about the fire engines and they just didn't believe it. What would we do about it? What would we pull out? What could we do? And here, I can guarantee you, you're going to see them muster all the evidence that they're going to pull out. Not only their memory, but I've written this three times, Dad. It's in my handwriting. We've said it over and over. I remember it happened. This is going to get them to be an apologist about events that happened in their life that they know happened. And of course, it can parallel the same thing that the disciples went through with regards to Jesus and trying to prove it to the Jews and to the Gentiles and so forth. She plays the role of an apologist and doesn't even know it. So after that, we get into high school, and it's here where I say it's full on. We are expanding the model where we are certainly teaching at their level, but it is a systematic course from ground zero to the conclusion that Christianity is true and everything opposed to Christianity is false. This is 9th through 12th grade. I don't care which grade you do it in. Most schools are going to do it in 11th and 12th grade. That is a full class on Christian apologetics, homeschool, probably the same time. And that's fine. There's no problems with that. It's here where we are going to deal with issues of truth, encounter the relativity, the cultural view of relativity of truth, of knowledge, how we know is going to become extremely important, the establishment of first principles or self-evident truths, upon which we will go to the second level and build arguments for the existence of God. Because God exists, miracles are possible and can serve as a sign from God, deal with objections such as evil and contrary worldviews, and adjudicate those worldviews, showing that the Christian worldview of theism, in fact, is true. Building upon that, then we get deal with issues and questions related to the Bible and, of course, Jesus Christ and his resurrection, which is a full systematic course in Christian apologetics. Now, one thing that this guy put together to help parents, teachers, pastors to develop their own curriculum. It's a philosophical foundations book with regards to teaching Christian apologetics in the secondary school level. There's nothing about the earlier school levels or elementary in there. I may make some ancillary references to it, but there's nothing, none of the curriculum I showed you is in there. This is for secondary school level alone, where I provide you what the curriculum is, the nature of Christian education in terms of the curriculum itself, the nature of apologetics as a subject of study, which we've talked about here. And then I actually give samples of a curriculum as well with respect to the whole notion. In the back there, I've got some appendices that actually give you samples of what curriculum should look like in terms of formalized instruction at the secondary school level. And I lay it out over an 18-week period that, of course, you can adjust to be more intensive or less intensive and spread out over an entire year. But I give you the full objectives and outcomes that should be expected for a secondary school teacher at that level. Some textbooks. This is not a textbook for the secondary school student to use. This is a resource for pastors, teachers, and parents, or people that want to teach apologetics, to give them the foundation they need to do it correctly in terms of methodology and so forth. Two textbooks I would recommend if you're looking at something 9th through 12th grade. This book was written at about a 9th grade level. Dr. Geiser's it's been reprinted, When Skeptics Ask. So it's got a different cover, so don't look for this cover. This is the old cover that it came out in. But it's very good because it has a nice question and answer approach. It has, each chapter has a question and it's broken down into questions. And he's got an appendices in there that gives you the 12 points to Christianity. If you're in the 11th or 12th grade, I would recommend, there may be some prepping that needs to go on, but this is definitely at their level, 11th or 12th grade, the book by Dr. Geiser and Frank Turk, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. In fact, I'll show it to you in the last slide here, but the lay Institute that Southern Evangelical Seminary just put together is using this, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, as their main textbook for the first module of the class. But this is the 12 points that show Christianity is true. Going down from that, middle junior high resource, this is grade 6th grade. These are some things I've looked at. There may be stuff out there I have not looked at, but everything I'm giving you I know can be incorporated into a classical approach to apologetics. I think Living Loud is a very good text that deals with, at their level, reasons for God. That's done, again, by Dr. Geiser. And there's a lot of stuff that's very evidential-based, but again, in the right context of classical apologetics, you can use the evidential works to help give reasons for the resurrection and so forth, that kind of learning. So these are some good resources there. When you get even below that into the preschool, if you want a book or a resource, in fact, I started with my daughter reading through the questions book series. She thought it was cool. I showed it to her and we started reading. There's too many questions. Kids don't ask that many questions. It's a good resource for the parent to perhaps incorporate into devotions they would normally do from the Bible every now and then. Do a question from this book, prepare, develop your own answers. There are some parents that may disagree with some of the answers in there. That's fine. But it gives you some resources and it prompts you some verses related to the question to develop your answers. And I think it's really good if the child sees the question answer method coming from the parent. And there's an open environment to allow the child at this age to ask their own questions if they have any. And let it be prompted by them and say, oh, that's a really good question. If you don't know the answer and can't deal with it right there, tell your child, I'm going to research that. I'm going to prepare for that. The child coming to the parent and the authority and asking the question is extremely important to their development. They should do that, and that's important. And you don't have to have all the answers. And the fact that the child knows that you go and research plays for them a role model that later they will produce in their life, that when they're asked a question they don't know the answer to, they say, well, Mom and Dad used to go research whenever I would ask them a question, and they can move on and develop that pattern in their life as well. At this point, I'll go ahead and see if there's any questions, and I'll be glad to ask. I don't know if we've gone over or we're late or whatever, but Again, I work at Southern Evangelical Seminary. If you need to email me, you're welcome to email me anytime. Questions, I can direct you to resources, or if you have questions about other things. We offer classes in online as well as on campus if you're local, and obviously many classes in Christian apologetics, and this one as well. I think this is for the parent that doesn't want a degree, that doesn't need to be professionally trained. This is ideal. The first module, I actually wrote the curriculum that surrounds the first. Dr. Geiser is the teacher for the first module, and I wrote the curriculum. That is all the test questions that go with it and doing well. So I'm very much interested in promoting this and getting it out there. I think it is just absolutely number one. It's financially affordable, and it's educationally sound in apologetics. And I think it's really going to be a great experience for anyone that wants to do it. And it's ideal for a parent that obviously can't formally study or even maybe perhaps afford a formal study in apologetics. This can get that kind of study to them